Welcome to Twill, the Week in Health Law, the festive podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on December 14th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host, Frank Pasquale, is away on assignment today in the U.S. Senate. This week on Twill, we have a special health law and policy holiday show featuring a great lineup of returning friends of the show. First up is Nicole Huberfeld, the Ashland Spears Distinguished Research Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. Hi, Nikki.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Happy holidays. Next, Nicholas Bagley, Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. Welcome back, Nick.
Thank you. It's a bunch of Nicks for Christmas.
And third, Elizabeth Weeks Leonard, Professor of Law, and if I may jump the gun by a few days, the J. Alton Horsch Professor of Law. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The University of Georgia. Welcome back, Liz.
Great to be here.
Although given the company and not wishing to displease the Hogfather, we may have to call you an honorary Nick or Nikki or something.
I would be so honored.
Very well. We're going to have a couple of lightning rounds for this special show. And round one is, in 2015, who or what was naughty or who was nice? Nicole.
So I have a fairly extensive list that is also somewhat random because, as we all do, I tend to think about the things that have happened recently, and I wanted to think back a little bit on the year as well. So I'm going to bounce a little bit between nice and naughty, if that's okay with you, Nick. And I'd like to start with the obvious, which is the ACA is nice. And the reason that I say the ACA is nice is that we have somewhere between 17 and 20 million newly insured people in the United States. The rate of uninsurance is the lowest it's been in about 8 years. Many of the people who have been aided by the ACA are exactly those who were intended to be aided, which is people earning less than 250% of the federal poverty level. There have been big changes, particularly with regard to populations that traditionally have been excluded or have even suffered harms in the American healthcare system. So, for example, African Americans and Hispanics have seen particularly notable drops in their rates of uninsurance. We've seen recently a report that there's a decrease in trouble paying for medical bills, down from 21.3% in 2011 to 16.5% in 2015. And so these are the very reasons that arguably the ACA was created in 2010 to get uninsurance out of our horizon, to get people at least through that gateway in American healthcare where they have insurance and have some form of consistent access to care rather than simply relying on emergency departments. And so I think those numbers are important for arguing the nice point on the ACA. Now, on the naughty side, one could state that there's continuing litigation about the ACA. I don't want to preclude the comments of either of my co-guests, but I do think that it's worth noting that the ACA isn't entirely stable, and that's certainly not what I'm trying to represent here, simply that by these numbers, the ACA qualifies, in my book, as nice. To that end, I would say that the states that have expanded Medicaid, and that may just be Montana this year, but I hold out hope, as anyone who's ever heard me talk before knows, I do think that many more states will continue to opt into the Medicaid expansion. The Medicaid expansion is incredibly important for people right around the federal poverty level. And the states that continue to look like holdouts are actually moving in the direction of joining. So South Dakota, Louisiana, Utah, these states are on the cusp. And so I would put them in the nice category as well. On the other hand, my current state of residence, Kentucky, is on the naughty list because Kentucky's new governor, Governor Bevin, has made all kinds of statements about what he thinks he can do with the Medicaid expansion that has been wildly successful in Kentucky. And so it remains to be seen whether he actually qualifies as naughty in the end, but I do take as a hint that Governor Pence of Indiana was present at the inauguration of Governor Bevin, and so that says to me that I think he is going to do the first sort of whiplash maneuver of all of the opt-in states. I think that he may try to scale back what was sort of a pure, straightforward ACA in structure expansion of Medicaid and also use of a model state exchange for private insurance. And so he continues to say that he wants to switch to the federal exchange, which now appears that would cost the state tens of millions of dollars, and it also would cost more in administrative fees for people who enroll through healthcare.gov. And he seems to be exploring some kind of waiver that would be semi-punitive in nature, sort of like Indiana's. And so right now I have to put Kentucky on the naughty list, unfortunately. I would also say naughty was the Supreme Court in Armstrong versus Exceptional Child Center. In that case, the court said no more private rights of action to enforce fair payment in Medicaid, even when the state itself has said that it needs to pay its providers more money. But on the nice list, in response, HHS came out with regulations finally after a long hiatus in the Federal Register, and these final regulations with a comment period make it look like HHS is finally putting some teeth into its desire to see fair payment in Medicaid. So I think that's a good thing. Also on the nice list, the notice of proposed rulemaking for the common rule. We're finally seeing some movement forward on that. Holly and Glenn had a really nice Twill podcast on this a few podcasts ago, and so I recommend that to everybody. But the short version is the common rule is due for some updating, and it seems like all the federal agencies that are interested in the common rule are finally looking to make that happen in a handful of ways that I think most importantly will probably make informed consent more meaningful. And so I think that falls on the nice list. On the naughty list, I would add pharmaceutical companies that are fleecing Americans with their prices. I would also add governors and federal legislators that are seeking to defund Planned Parenthood. And I would throw in states like Texas that are pushing against the Casey framework that protects the constitutional right to obtain an abortion in privacy. I have probably sucked up all of my time, and so I'll stop there.
Wow, that's a long list. You've really going to keep Santa busy. so, Nick, are you giving out coal or candy this year, sir?
Well, I'm going to keep my list a little bit shorter and more confined. I will second everything that Nikki said about the ACA and its continuing steps to improve health insurance coverage for people who traditionally have been unable to secure it. And obviously, we should say, give a big shout out to the Supreme Court for being nice in King against Burwell, a completely sensible decision about the scope of the tax credits under the Affordable Care Act. But I want to focus today on what's happening at the states, and in particular on the Second Circuit, which I think has been quite naughty. So one of the most exciting developments in state efforts to improve healthcare markets has been the development over the past decades of about, depending on how you count, 16 or 18 all-payer claims databases within the states. And the idea behind these databases is that the states will collect information about how much health plans are paying for the healthcare services that they're purchasing. And if this sounds like a fairly modest step, it's not. It's transformative. In the past, this information about how much we were paying for healthcare was a closely guarded trade secret, at least on the private side. We could see it on the Medicare side. We could see it on the Medicaid side. But we didn't know how much health plans were paying for care. And without that information, it's really hard to see how all these new transparency initiatives are ever going to pan out. And it's really hard to get a handle on what sorts of state reform efforts might work and which sorts of state reform efforts don't work. So these states have created these new databases in an effort to shed some light on what we are all collectively paying for healthcare. Well, the Second Circuit heard a case involving a challenge to one state's all-payer claims database, and that state is Vermont. And the employer that challenged the all-payer claims database is Liberty Mutual. And Liberty Mutual said, that's fine, Vermont, that you want to create an all-payer claims database, but we don't want to play ball, and we don't think we have to play ball. And the reason is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which is a complicated statute that sets basic rules for employers that wish to create employee benefit plans. Some of those employee benefit plans are, of course, to provide health coverage. And so Liberty Mutual said, look, ERISA sets the rules by which we establish our health benefits plans. And if you look at ERISA, it says that state laws that relate to such employee benefit plans, all those state laws have to give way. They are preempted. And the Second Circuit bought it. The Second Circuit said, so long as you are a self-insured employer, you do not have to share any information with the all-payer claims databases in your state. And since about two-thirds of people who receive employer-sponsored coverage get their coverage through firms that self-insure, the Second Circuit's decision has the effect of blowing a huge hole in these new databases and blinding us where we were trying to make it possible to see something that had been invisible for a long time. The Supreme Court, fortunately, has granted cert. Oral argument was heard in the case last month, and oral argument just a few weeks ago, in fact. Oral argument was kind of a mixed bag. I can't say that the people who are hoping that the Second Circuit's argument is reversed were thrilled with the argument. I think it was a difficult one to call or difficult one to handicap. There were hard questions asked of both sides, but I think there is some reason to fear that the Supreme Court could compound the Second Circuit's naughtiness. And I, for one, am hoping that they do not.
And Nick / Liz, what can you tell us about the happenings of the year?
It's hard not to have the Supreme Court and Chief Justice Roberts in particular at the top of my nice list. And I do want to take a minute to talk about that. I think most listeners are certainly familiar with that case and its importance, but certainly the fact that the chief for the second and arguably third, if you bifurcate the decision in FIB, saved the Affordable Care Act from these right-wing think tank fueled attacks that I think most of us who work in this area and think in this area thought were bogus attacks from the outset. And the fact that they made it much farther than they ever should have is telling, but certainly that the court stepped in and decided to reject those attacks is significant. So I give props to the chief and to the court for that. That said, the naughties, the right wing's attacks have not stopped. And among other items, I'll talk about Marco Rubio in a minute, but there continues to be the next generation of healthcare freedom acts being proposed as model legislation. We might remember that in the early days of ACA implementation, states like Virginia and other states enacted laws purporting to say that the individual health insurance mandate would not apply within their state borders. Any second year constitutional law student knows that states can't opt out of federal law, that those laws are preempted. The next wave of that sort of Healthcare Freedom Act is now a proposal that states should implement provisions penalizing insurance companies if they accept federal subsidies. So King versus Burwell says that all states, whether they are have federally operated or state operated exchanges, that subsidies are available to citizens of those states. This new proposed model legislation would say that those insurance companies in those states cannot accept federal subsidies as another way of undermining the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. But that's at least for now pie in the sky. As we've seen, however, these sorts of ideas get more traction than we expect. The one that really is disturbing and who I would put on my naughty list is Marco Rubio. So Senator of Florida, who slipped into spending legislation last year, a provision which guts the implementation of the Affordable Care Act in a different way. Effectively, what he did was cut funding to the risk corridor provision of the Affordable Care Act. And risk corridors were included within the legislation to protect insurance companies as they entered into the new health insurance exchange marketplaces from the possibility that they may take on greater risk than they anticipated. So the risk corridors essentially are a government backstop or a reinsurance for these insurance companies if they experience medical claims above a certain expected amount. And the provision that Rubio managed to insert in legislation basically had the result of some insurance companies receiving pennies on the dollar, 13% of what they were promised in the legislation. And that has been detrimental to some of the new players in this market. 12 of the new 23 nonprofit insurance cooperatives created under the law have failed. And many insureds and customers have experienced disruption in their coverage as a result of this. So again, a little known provision. The new front of attack on the Affordable Care Act is in the intricacies. I think that The Supreme Court has rebuffed the major attacks, but I think we will continue to see these smaller inroads that could have similarly devastating impacts.
I'm going with the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC strikes me as the only federal body really pulling its weight when faced with the present and future of health policy. While not completely naughty, I think the FDA seems stalled on a whole range of topics, from e-cigarette regulation, mobile medical apps, and off-label prescribing. And CMS just doesn't seem to have been bold enough on issues such as telemedicine reimbursement or explaining to us what this move to value is going to look like. As for Congress, I think the lack of progress seems only equaled by its lack of transparency. I still don't really have a clue as to what will be in the 21st Century Cures Act, if we ever see it this century. So I'm going to toss coal in all of their directions. But FTC, you've been nice. As an agency, I think you seem to get two major issues. First, that the kind of institutional integration called for by the ACA may end up with some anti-competitive effects. The agency's been on a winning streak for a while, successfully challenging hospital mergers, and most recently the agency has moved against a proposed acquisition in Huntington, West Virginia, that it says would substantially lessen competition. FTC has also been on the trail of anti-competitive behaviors, touching on health information technology, alas also opening up the dreaded information blocking diversion. It's also taken on some of the most entrenched restraints in healthcare. For example, the North Carolina teeth whitening case where SCOTUS found for the agency in denying the state antitrust immunity when active market participants were in regulatory positions. Though I'm sure if he was here, Frank would like me to add that Justice Alito's dissent may yet be predictive of implementation problems. The second major issue, I think, where FTC has scored well is with regard to online healthcare privacy and security, where the agency's careful strategy is laying down a powerful case law-based doctrine to try and fill the HIPAA-free zone problems that Congress has ignored. An unchallenged aspect of the LabMD case is that FTC will act against even HIPAA-regulated entities. Meanwhile, the DC Circuit upheld FTC in the Palm Wonderful case, which establishes a rigorous evidence-based standard under the deceit prong of Section 5A of the FTC Act, which was used by the agency in the Mole app cases. And of course, there's the huge Third Circuit win in the Wyndham case, establishing that the unfairness prong of the same section could be triggered in the case of multiple cybersecurity lapses. As to who's been really naughty, well, I think the whole interoperability mess that ONC and Congress have got themselves into is beginning to look like a poster for regulatory failure. So on to round two. Nick, who or what would make you happy in the new year?
So the Affordable Care Act still has one major judicial challenge still pending against it. And this is a lawsuit brought by the House of Representatives seeking to defund the cost-sharing reductions that help people afford the out-of-pocket payments that they would otherwise have to make on the exchanges. So just to be more specific, if you buy a health plan on the exchange and you make less than 250% of poverty, you're going to have a hard time paying the deductibles and co-payments and the rest that are required of you under these fairly high-deductible health plans, unless you get some help. And so the cost-sharing reductions tell health plans that they've got to slash the amount of cost-sharing they impose on you. And in exchange, the federal government will then pay those health plans the amount that they to compensate them for cutting your cost-sharing amounts. The House of Representatives has filed suit to challenge the administration's payment of the cost-sharing reductions. And the argument is that there is no appropriation for that money, that Congress, yes, it instructed the federal government to pay health plans the cost-sharing reductions, but that Congress never actually got around to formally appropriating the money. Now, when this lawsuit was filed, most observers thought it was going nowhere fast because the House of Representatives doesn't traditionally have standing to challenge the administration's interpretation of an appropriations statute. It's certainly not the kind of thing that you could make a federal case out of. But instead of dismissing the case on standing grounds, the district court last year in D.C. said, you know what, I think the House of Representatives does have standing to press this appropriations challenge. And she ordered briefing on the merits of the question of whether or not, in fact, an appropriation exists for the money. The government and the House of Representatives have both filed their opening briefs to the court, and the court will accept final briefs, I think, towards the end of January, and presumably decide the case sometime in the spring. There's reason to fear that the district court might invalidate the cost-sharing reductions on the ground that there is no appropriation. So I will put it as a hope that in the coming year, we can put on our nice list a district court who comes to what I think is the more sensible conclusion that this isn't the kind of lawsuit that should be in the federal courts and dismiss it post haste.
So Liz, are you going to have a happy new year?
Well, I hope so. I hope I'm going to have a happy new year. And I want to talk about two things that would make me happy. Well, one makes me happy, the fact that the court even took it. And that was the case that Nick Bagley talked about earlier, the Gobier ERISA case. And for me, it's an ERISA case, and that's what makes it exciting, because I am kind of a self-declared nerd in that area of law, and not many people find it so joyous. But the court will be deciding this issue under ERISA 502 preemption scheme. Is we haven't had one of those cases in a while, and for somebody who likes to teach in that area, I think that's a good thing. So that will make me happy to see how the court analyzes that. The 502 issue, this ERISA 502 issue in the case, concerns the first prong of the preemption analysis, which is the extent to which this requirement on disclosure requirement relates to employee benefit plans, and if it does relate to, whether it has been preempted or whether it's some other form of regulation that just doesn't even bear on the ERISA preemption scheme. So that's interesting. And the last time that we had really any significant ERISA 502A analysis was an issue that didn't reach the Supreme Court because the Affordable Care Act supplanted it. And that was a question of state employer pay or play laws. Now that we have a federal employer shared responsibility provision, those state provisions no longer are an issue, but there were questions under ERISA with respect to that. So that gets me deep into the wonky arena, and I'll move on to another case, which I'm interested in watching, which is also at the Supreme Court. And as I was thinking about these comments, it's actually notable, I think, that we have so much discussion of healthcare law at the Supreme Court. So much of what we do in the healthcare space typically is not high court litigation. It's in the regulatory and statutory weeds. So it's exciting. We sort of, you know, we've come into our own, I think, as a field, at least in terms of the court's eyes. But another case that I'm watching in the new year is Universal Health Services, Inc. versus United States Ex Relator Escobar. And it's a federal False Claims Act case involving the legal validity of the implied certification theory. So what the False Claims Act provides is that for any government contractor, not just healthcare contractors, submission of a false claim can subject the entity to civil and criminal penalties. A question that has been open and on which circuits have been split is what constitutes a false claim, and particularly whether just failure to comply with other federal or state requirements that are in the mix of claims submitted to the federal government for payment make those claims false for purposes of the False Claims Act. So under the facts of the Universal Health Services case, a mental health clinic in Massachusetts received both state and federal Medicaid funds, and there was a woman in care of the clinic died, and her parents were the relators, the whistleblowers, who brought a False Claims Act against the healthcare provider. And their allegation was that the clinic staff were unlicensed and unsupervised in violation of state regulations. And therefore, by submitting claims to the state and federal government under Medicaid, those claims were false because they were involved care provided by these unlicensed and unsupervised providers. The First Circuit allowed this claim to go forward, which effectively has the result of saying that any violation of a requirement, a statutory or regulatory requirement, makes the claim false for purposes of federal, civil, and criminal liability. So that has significant
effects for providers who already are quite concerned about the exposure they have under the False Claims Act, and especially with whistleblower actions, these relator actions. So I think, and as a, you know, somebody with a history as a practitioner representing providers, it would make me happy if the Supreme Court rejects this implied false certification theory and requires more specific violations of laws on which payment is premised in order to support a False Claims Act allegation.
My temptation was to nominate the end of narrow networks and high deductibles that seem poised, if not actually designed, to undo so much of what the Affordable Care Act has achieved. I guess we'll see some CMS action in the new year, and I'm also hoping that maybe the states will get a little more involved. But overall, I decided not to go for that particular wish, but rather to hope for some movement on pricing. I think a great start would be to repeal the long-criticized 2003 MMA's Medicare Part D non-interference requirement, which I still consider one of the most embarrassing pieces of legislation over the last few decades. Thereafter, and of course that probably means after the election, we have to begin a real discussion on the most effective way to deal with pricing. I suspect that neither transparency nor, for example, the fast tracking of generics will be enough. Neither will be going after outliers such as Valiant. They seem capable of shooting themselves in their own feet, and it's probably not worth our while. I also think, seconding Nick, that the conversation is only going to get worse if the payment databases get closed down. Given the entrenched stakeholders and our history, I'm not optimistic, but even moderate progress would make my new year happy. Without it, I'm not sure where we go with future positive healthcare reform. And finally, Nicole, what's going to make your new year happier?
I would like to turn again to the case that I mentioned earlier, Whole Woman's Health versus Cole. This is a blockbuster case for the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court hasn't heard a case that builds on Casey and Roe since 2007. I frankly think it's hard to tell where the court is going to go with this case, but it's really important, particularly in light of the efforts to, as I said in my naughty list, defund Planned Parenthood, because there's sort of this two-front attack, particularly for poor women, on their ability to control their reproduction. And so what's happening in this case is Texas created a rule that said if you're a person who provides, if you're a doctor who provides abortions, you have to provide them in a facility that is basically an ambulatory surgery center. It has the same kind of surgical facility as a hospital might have. And you need to be within 30 miles of a hospital that can admit a person who's had an abortion if something goes wrong with the abortion. And so the challengers to this law are saying, well, there's no health-based reason to institute this licensure requirement because abortion is actually statistically one of the safest surgical procedures that exists so long as it's performed in a safe and legal environment. And particularly in the first trimester, it's actually safer than pregnancy. And so the argument is this is an undue burden under Casey's reformulation of Roe's upholding of the right to privacy, protecting the ability to terminate pregnancy. And it's an important challenge. It does get at some of the holes in the superstructure that Casey basically created for states to be able to understand where they could or could not regulate in the realm of reproduction. And I think that the ripple effects will be important because what we've seen in the modern era in thinking about these reproductive rights questions is that it doesn't just have to do with abortion. It also reaches into things like fertility, what happens in these cases, and what happens in fertility clinics, and what happens with unused fetuses and embryos from IVF. And so I think that the ripple effects could be quite a bit greater than anybody's really thinking about in the moment and looking at Whole Woman's Health. So I'm watching this one very closely. I, as I said, am uncertain as to where the court is going to go with it, but I think it is obvious, at least to anyone who takes Casey and Roe seriously, that these kinds of restrictions, and Texas is not the only state to create this kind of licensure law, are designed to create a burden on accessing abortion. They have made it so that many clinics have shut down. There are women who have to travel more than 200 miles now if they want to access a safe and legal abortion. And so any serious look at it will tell you that this is an undue burden under Casey. But this court has also shown a willingness to change the law, and that may happen here. I would like to see more Medicaid expansion, just to ring that bell one more time, because I think that will happen. I would like to not see the repeal of the so-called Cadillac tax, because there is no corresponding increase in funding that appears to be on the table if that tax is repealed. And so I think that would be short-sighted to simply repeal that tax, because it sounds good to repeal a tax without thinking about the subsequent budgetary implications of such a move. And then finally, I would like to hear less of the let's give control back to the states line of argument. The reason that the federal government got involved in healthcare in the first place decades ago is that the states couldn't handle it. And we seem to be very short on our historical memory on that count. And I could talk about that for days, but I should probably stop there and simply say that I agree with everything all three of you have said as well. So thank you for your fine analyses.
Well, I think we have time for just one very quick unannounced bonus round. And I'd like to ask each of you, who would you like to find singing festive songs outside your house one chilly night over the holiday season? Let me give you time to think. I'll give you my vote. It's for Justice Scalia, and I want to hear him sing some kind of hymn, maybe with a blues take on SCOTUS care.
Just for the sake of, you know, its sheer bombastic perversity, I'd love to see Donald Trump outside my window showing me what a real health plan looks like.
I'm going to go in the opposite direction and vote Jimmy Fallon, because he's just funny. And pretty much the rest of it is, too.
And I'm going to go with the FLOTUS with the mostest, Michelle Obama rapping anything in his tune. And our host, Nick Terry, singing anything in his marvelous accent.
And on that embarrassing note, that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A fantastic show. Thank you so much, Professors Huberfeld, Bagley, and Leonard, for joining us. Thanks to you all.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, Nick.
Great fun. So we post our show notes at twill.com. Also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you've got any cash left over at the end of the year, which you probably don't. Or, of course, for that last-minute gift, you could always buy one of our Twill t-shirts and exclaim your health geekiness. Also, if you've got a moment, go to iTunes and rate the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And although he couldn't join us today, but believe us, he was doing something really important. My usual co-host is at Frank Pasquale on Twitter. Happy holidays, Frank, and thanks for making this a really special year by co-hosting Twill. Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy holidays.